It does seem as if the Democrats, and they're trying to push the Trump administration to take an anti-Moscow posture, have largely succeeded, because Donald J. Trump folded like a cheap suit when it came to Syria. And it seems as if Washington is headed to a confrontation with Moscow over this question of Syria, and it will not be pretty.
In a time when it feels like the military and the culture of violence have colonized so much of our lives, our land, our economy, our culture, and in so many cases, even our churches, there is one part of us that cannot be colonized, at least not permanently, and that is the conscience. And that fact poses a great threat to the ability to make and perpetuate war.
Welcome to On the Ground, onthegroundshow.org, voices of resistance from the nation's capital, produced for WPFW Pacifica Radio in Washington, D.C. I'm Esther Ivarum, and as always, we have a lot of news and information for you packed into our hour. This week, the focus in D.C. is on war. While the Trump regime attacks Syria and rattles the saber over North Korea and Yemen, progressives here and around the country took out time to mark the 100th anniversary of this country's entry into World War I and the 50th anniversary of the historic speech by the Reverend Martin Luther King Jr. opposing the Vietnam War, which killed more than 3 million Vietnamese people and left their country to this day polluted by chemical weapons and riddled with unexploded munitions. All that is coming up, but first some headlines. The Health Over Profit Coalition, which includes doctors and other medical professionals who support Medicare for All, is holding a Our Health is Not for Sale Speak Out Today, April 7th at noon, in front of the Office of the Department of Health and Human Services, while Senator Bernie Sanders recently introduced legislation that would add an attractive public option and expand Medicare in the current Affordable Care Act. The organizer for Health Over Profit urged Democrats to push for universal coverage for all Americans, instead of trying to fix the Affordable Care Act. This is Dr. Margaret Flowers.
We have to be very clear from the get-go that the Affordable Care Act cannot be fixed. It was written by the insurance industry for the insurance industry, and it is fundamentally flawed for that reason. We know that the first step and the small step that we can take to address the health care crisis is national improved Medicare for All. That's what we have to be fighting for. That's what we can do. The majority of people want it. So we've got to urge Senator Sanders to do a strong push for a strong national improved Medicare for All bill. We're not going to accept anything less.
Physicians for a National Health Care Program and several other organizations are also organizing a day of action for single-payer health care on Saturday, April 8th, to meet lawmakers returning to their home districts for a two-week recess. They will ask members of Congress to support H.R. 676, the Expanded and Improved Medicare for All Act, which would replace the Affordable Care Act, or Obamacare, with a streamlined plan that researchers estimate will save about $500 billion annually. Earlier this week, before Trump's Thursday attack on Syria, social movement leaders from groups across the progressive spectrum launched a campaign denouncing Trump's proposed $54 billion increase in the U.S. military budget, which is coming at the expense of the environment, education, human and civil rights protections, and public health. The No $54 billion for War effort, that's a hashtag, No $54 billion for War, launched on the 50th anniversary of Martin Luther King Jr.'s speech Beyond Vietnam, A Time to Break the Silence, which warned that, quote, a nation that continues year after year to spend more money on military defense than on programs of social uplift is approaching spiritual death, end quote. Medea Benjamin of Code Pink said that the bloated military budget proposal was bringing to the anti-war movement groups that have not wanted to touch it in the past.
It's been very hard to get the peace issue inserted. Now that we have $54 billion that is clearly coming from the budgets of other people's, other organizations, things they care about, whether it's the EPA or whether it's Wheels on Wheels or whether it's the health departments or education or humanitarian aid, other organizations are starting to understand that this is directly affecting the work that they're doing.
More from Medea's talk later in the show. But also on April 4th, marking the 50th anniversary of King's speech against the Vietnam War, there was a program at Georgetown University. Chantel James filed this report.
50 years ago to the day on Tuesday, Martin Luther King Jr. delivered his seminal speech, Beyond Vietnam, A Time to Break the Silence, where he drew connections between social justice movements and the need for an anti-war stance. Looking back to that day, Georgetown University hosted an all-day symposium where activists and others from all over the community came to talk solutions. The day culminated in a panel dialogue moderated by history professor Marsha Chatelain. Old heads of the struggles of the 60s and 70s came together with contemporary leaders of movements like Black Lives Matter. Panelists included Reverend Osefeo Ujuru Seku, who has been working tirelessly to connect social justice to the mandates of the Christian faith. Here, Reverend Seku demands that we draw strength from the past without romanticizing it.
Nostalgia is a form of mourning because the present is unbearable and the future is unforeseeable. And so one of the ways we talk about the civil rights movement, particularly around the question of the way in which we folded the black freedom struggle neatly within the narrative of the American empire, as though it was inevitable. And so, by August 1966, according to a Myers poll, King's approval rating is 12%. 12% of Americans approve of him and what he's doing. The vast majority of Americans believe that the exact words, freedom rides, sit-ins are hurting their cause. 57% of Americans believe that the freedom rides, Martin Luther King, and the sit-ins were hurting their cause. Poll September 2015, 55% of Americans believe that Black Lives Matter is hurting its cause. Black Lives Matter is actually polled higher than Martin Luther King. And so we want to just kind of be clear about the historical contradictions that are at work.
From the campus of Georgetown University, this is Chantal James.
And those are our headlines and happenings for today. When we come back, my interview with Gerald Horn. Stay with us. To discuss more about issues of war and peace, and this week in Washington, I'm joined by On the Ground's geopolitical analyst Gerald Horn, writer, activist, and professor of history and African American studies at the University of Houston. Well, Gerald, in D.C. this week, it seems as though the war hawks have gotten the upper hand in pushing this country further into conflicts around the world. Listening to corporate media immediately blame Syria's President Bashar al-Assad for a chemical attack with no proof, kind of felt like deja vu to me, as attempts have been made for regime change in Syria and then succeeded in those attempts in Libya and Iraq. So I want to get your take on what looks like a horrific massacre in Syria.
Well, it is deja vu all over again. Recall that in August 2013, there was a similar incident where the drums of war were beating, led by the Washington Post and the New York Times and the cable news channels. A subsequent investigation by independent journalist Seymour Hersh pointed out that during that chemical attack, it was not the regime in Damascus that was responsible. It was thought to have been the rebels themselves. That, in fact, is the line that's being put forward by Damascus and their allies in Moscow. And indeed, that is what has been suggested by Robert Perry and Consortium News. But it does seem as if the Democrats, and they're trying to push the Trump administration to take an anti-Moscow posture, have largely succeeded, because Donald J. Trump folded like a cheap suit when it came to Syria. And it seems as if Washington is headed to a confrontation with Moscow over this question of Syria, and it will not be pretty.
Well, this week in D.C. and around the country, there were programs also marking 100 years after the United States entered World War I and 50 years after the Reverend Martin Luther King Jr. made his speech in opposition to the Vietnam War. And the program here, which we will actually play voices from later in the show, talked about how the First World War was also the start of this country's war propaganda machine, as well as the military-industrial complex. But I can't help but be reminded of that as I survey what is in corporate media, not just about Syria, but about North Korea, China, and even Russia. So given everything that's happened this week, what are your thoughts about media's role and what we are experiencing?
Well, what you're pointing to is part of the contradiction with the anti-Trump forces. That is to say that these forces are led by the Washington Post and the New York Times, to their credit, but at the same time, they're undermining their anti-Trump posture and whipping up right-wing hysteria because of their right-wing thrust on international questions, not only with regard to Syria, not only with regard to North Korea, but with regard to Venezuela, for example, where they're still involved in trying to undermine the Maduro regime. They don't seem to recognize that if they're trying to pursue a right-wing foreign policy, ultimately that only benefits the right-wing impulses of Donald J. Trump. Now, with regard to World War I, the same contradiction that was in place 100 years ago is still in place today. That is to say, the people of the United States were fed the propaganda line that the United States should intervene in World War I in order to make the world safe for democracy. And of course, the question that black radicals were asking then, why don't you make the United States safe for democracy? Huh. And that contradiction still holds today. That is to say that black people in particular, but not exclusively, are asked to make the ultimate blood sacrifice to supposedly make the world a better place when they do not and we do not enjoy democracy at home.
Well, speaking of democracy at home, this week, I guess, as we speak, you know, President Trump is meeting with Chinese President Xi Jinping, and there was a lot of rhetoric on his part about how the meeting was not going to be easy, that he was going to confront China about its so-called unfair trade policies and its currency manipulation. So what exactly is he talking about? And hasn't China been working with U.S. corporations to their benefit, but also to the corporations' benefit?
Well, precisely. And this claim that China is supposedly manipulating the value of its currency in order to capture export markets has been debunked, not least by Paul Krugman in the New York Times. Now, I know that you like to ask this question, which is quite appropriate, which is, what is the bit of news that has not penetrated the mainstream media?
Right.
And this is an item that is hiding in plain sight. That is to say that what has helped to create this juggernaut in Asia, speaking of the People's Republic of China, is precisely U.S. imperialism. And that's something that the mainstream press does not tell its readers. That is to say that four odd decades ago, U.S. President Richard M. Nixon went to China and he brokered a deal to turn China into a vector of opposition against the then Soviet Union. That was a key factor that helped to bring down the Soviet Union. But in return, China would receive massive amounts of inward foreign direct investment from U.S. corporations. Now, what's interesting about that is that the man who helped to engineer that deal was Henry Kissinger. Henry Kissinger, after stepping down as U.S. Secretary of State, helped to found a corporation called Kissinger Associates, which helped to open the door for U.S. corporations that want to invest in China and received a pretty penny in return, In other words, he helped to turn U.S. foreign policy in a certain direction, then left office and benefited from it. Now, the difference with Donald J. Trump is apparently he's trying to benefit from foreign policy while he's still in office. He's not waiting until he leaves office. And that's really the only difference, and that's something that the U.S. mainstream press is not telling its readers.
Well, some good news for those of us who are following Latin American politics, a victory for the left in Ecuador, vowing to continue programs that benefit the majority of the people there rather than the ruling class, the rich folks there. And I guess Julian Assange has dodged a bullet in terms of being able to stay in the Ecuadorian embassy in London.
That is great news, because we can expect more revelations from WikiLeaks as a result of the fact that the preferred candidate of the left triumphed during the Ecuadorian election. I'm speaking of the appropriately named Lenin Moreno. And what's interesting is that this was a shot in the arm for the much beleaguered Latin American left, which has not received a lot of good news lately. And in fact, one of the more disturbing trends that's taking place right now in Latin America is that the government of Mexico, which traditionally and routinely had taken a kind of hands-off policy with regard to interfering in the internal affairs of other Latin American nations, is apparently now reversing that policy under pressure from the Trump administration, or simply because they want to curry favor with the Trump administration. I'm speaking of the fact that the government in Mexico City, President Peña Nieto, has overturned the so-called Estrada Doctrine, which, as I said, ruled out any kind of interference in internal affairs of Latin American neighbors by taking the U.S. line and the New York Times line with regard to the recent events in Caracas, Venezuela. This is not very good news, and in many ways, it helps to erode the significance of the good news brought by the Ecuadorian election.
Well, here at home, two things caught my eye. Of course, the Senate voted, or Mitch McConnell made the decision on Thursday to employ the so-called nuclear option to approve the nomination of Neil Gorsuch to the Supreme Court. And almost right away, I started getting a flurry of email in my inbox from organizations vowing to somehow fight this, which seems, I don't know if it's futile or not, but what are your thoughts in terms of McConnell changing the rules so that Supreme Court justices can be nominated to a lifetime seat with just a majority vote?
Well, I don't think the Democrats had too much choice. They didn't have an alternative but to oppose Neil Gorsuch, because we're told that with the nuclear option now invoked, that this is going to guarantee that more right-wing Supreme Court justices get nominated and seated. But it's difficult to think of a judge more right-wing than Neil Gorsuch. He has made decisions that are totally inimical to the interests of working-class people. He's a corporatist. I'm sure you've heard of the frozen trucker case, so-called, where a trucker was faced with the possibility of freezing to death or staying in the cab of the truck. He decided to take the cab of the truck, unlink it from the trailer, and drive away rather than freeze to death. And Neil Gorsuch basically ruled that he should have stayed there and frozen to death. You know that Steve Bannon, Mr. Trump's advisor and strategist, has suggested that he wants to overthrow the administrative state. That is to say, he wants to overturn a number of regulatory agencies and overturn entities such as the Environmental Protection Administration. Well, Neil Gorsuch has been in the forefront of coming up with a theoretical basis for doing so. So I don't think the Democrats had a choice but to vote against Neil Gorsuch, and I don't think that the consequences are going to be as dire as we're told, because the consequences are dire already with Neil Gorsuch apparently ready to take the ninth seat on the U.S. Supreme Court.
Well, finally, I also noticed this lawsuit at Fox News by black employees charging racist treatment, discrimination from a white woman manager. And this is coming out in tandem with the growing boycott against the Bill O'Reilly show by several advertisers. So in the process of giving a lot of press to, a $13 million settlement made with women who say that they've been sexually harassed by Bill O'Reilly. We're also getting news about this other lawsuit. And it struck me because, you know, in all of the complaints about Fox News, I rarely hear the race angle mentioned. I rarely hear people talk about how racist Fox News is, even in terms of all the brouhaha about so-called fake news. We've had a channel delivering fake news for like a few decades now. And it just strikes me that Fox News does not get the type of attention it should about the racist element to its production. And now you have this lawsuit about what's happening behind the scenes.
Well, part of the good news there in terms of that Fox News case is that it reveals and exposes the conflict between the New York Times and Rupert Murdoch, the major shareholder in the Fox News channel. That is to say, the New York Times helped to bring forward the story about sexual harassment involving Bill O'Reilly, the TV host. It's also the New York Times, in terms of reporting that story, that gave a prominent play to the left-leaning entity out of Oakland, California, Color of Change, led by Rashard Robinson, which was pressuring advertisers to move away from Bill O'Reilly's show. And I'm sure that that's helped to drive funding into the coffers of Color of Change, which is good news. So it seems as if we in the progressive movement, or at least some of the progressive movement, may be benefiting from this dogfight between the New York Times and Fox News, and may that trend continue.
Well, we'll definitely keep an eye on that lawsuit. I've been speaking to our geopolitical analyst, the professor, writer, activist, Gerald Horn. Thank you so much, Gerald, for joining me.
Thank you.
Well, April 4th, 2017 marked 100 years since the United States entered World War I and 50 years since Martin Luther King Jr. made his famous speech against the Vietnam War. On the Ground attended the program Remembering Past Wars and Preventing the Next, sponsored by the organization World Beyond War at Busboys and Poets, 5th and K Street in Northwest Washington. Here are some voices of activists speaking that night.
Eugene Puryear is a journalist, an activist, an excellent radio host, the author, among other things, of Shackled and Chained, Mass Incarceration in Capitalist America. Welcome, Eugene Puryear.
Well, thank you, and I have to say for the record that David Swanson is a very good radio guest as well as host, so very thankful to him for inviting me here, but also being willing to share his commentary often on my show by any means necessary. You know, I think this is such an important anniversary, and I'm glad this event is taking place. I mean, I don't know this 100% for sure. I know something happened this afternoon, but it's possible if this didn't take place, there wouldn't have been any real sort of commemoration of the fact that the Riverside speech took place today, and I think people focus so much on the issue of Martin Luther King being assassinated also a year later on this day that it gets overshadowed. I had the full actual import of that didn't even hit me until David reached out to me for this event. I honestly, even though I know about both of them, didn't even realize they were on the same day. So I'm so appreciative to be here. I really sort of grew up on stories of Dr. King. My father is the founder of the Nonpartisan Voters League in Tuskegee, Alabama, and they worked with SCLC. So to some degree, the Kingian philosophy is very deep in why I do what I do today. I think it's always worth remembering because I think, especially for those of us who know, I mean, certainly the triple evils, poverty, militarism, and racism are still with us. And I think probably for many of us in this room, those are probably the three things that would put a good umbrella over a lot of the things we care a lot about and work towards. So they're certainly still with us. And so when I think about the sort of permanence of that reality, I also think, well, what are some of the things that we can take from Dr. King? Because I think you can go the other way, and I think the one way sometimes people say is, oh, we're still fighting the same fight, as if perhaps they weren't successful. And in some ways they weren't successful, but I still think there's a lot to be learned. So the first thing that I think about is the power of institutions and the importance of institutional change. I mean, I think especially towards the end of his life, if you look at the history of Dr. King, and certainly especially even many of his own advisors, I mean, not wanting him to step out against the war in Vietnam, but even though this is less well known, not being terribly supportive of the Poor People's Campaign, and in fact, people who were sort of in both camps trying to pit fighting against poverty and fighting against the war as two totally separate struggles and two totally separate things that, you know, you couldn't do without one without the other. You were mutually exclusive, and Dr. King was fighting for a synthetic vision of bringing those three things together. And I think, you know, one of the things that we often lose, I don't know if we lose it because the sort of moral language and the beauty of Dr. King's words and speeches and the knowledge that's in them, unfortunately we don't read his books as much as we talk about his speeches. And I think Chaos and Community, his final book, has a lot to teach us, but that's antithetical to this. I think a lot of it is sort of drawing and using the moral implications of certain practices and using the kind of comparison to almost human reality and morality to draw something, so it's something fundamentally wrong in the core of America. I think a lot of people would call it institutional. I think he was approaching it in almost sort of a humanized kind of way, almost in terms of a soul and a heart and how we conceive of ourselves as a country and a people and the things we would want to take forward. But it's notable that in the Riverside speech, he makes a very direct connection in terms of war making to profit making. And there's a direct line in there. I read it to someone earlier today and I can't remember the whole thing now. But the general gist of it being that people will look back on this moment and they'll see all, or they'll reflect on this moment and they'll see all this money that was being spent all the way overseas on all these wars, and it had nothing to do with any of these people in the countries, but only, I think he uses the exact phrase, the individual capitalist in the West. And I think that that's an important and a powerful thing, because I think so often the way we get taught, certainly in civics class, about political change in America is that it really is it's a question of individuals, right? It's a question of some people being bad, some people being good, removing the bad people and putting in the good people. And to some degree, that is true, but I think perhaps we all may agree with this, even some of the best people can't accomplish very much oftentimes, regardless of how logical it seems to be at the moment. And I think the focus of Dr. King on something institutional in America that drives a lot of these practices and that ultimately has to be uprooted and changed is absolutely key and absolutely important to understanding not only the work we have to do today, but the permanence of the work. Because when it's just about individuals, I think we can see right now how easy it is that things that seem settled are no longer so. You know, the second thing that I think is always so important to remember is the importance and the focus of culture, especially when we're talking about war and violence, which I think Dr. King, I mean, his famous quote, "My country is the greatest purveyor of violence on the planet Earth," is well known. I think the significance of it, though, isn't often fully grasped. I mean, America, I think, I could be wrong about this, but I actually think the United States is the most violent country in the world. You know, unfortunately, the poster child for violence in America is young black males, and the way violence is more or less sort of understood and discussed in our society is vis-a-vis community violence and, you know, Donald Trump's constant references to Chicago. But, you know, compared to what they're doing with drone strikes, it's... very little compares to that. Certainly they're not doing double taps on first responders to kill double the number of people like they were in Pakistan. But be that as it may, I think that it's something that we don't really recognize enough. I mean, whether it's the sporting events, and I thought that's why Colin Kaepernick taking that stand was so powerful. I mean, many people have taken a stand around the issue of police brutality. Many people have taken bold stands and brave stands around the issues of police violence. But the fact that, and I think you can see in the response to Colin Kaepernick when he kneeled during the anthem, the unbelievable just vitriol that went towards him, even to the point where so many people were like, well, we're not saying that he can't speak out, but you can't do it in the anthem. Don't do it during the anthem. And I mean, just the unbelievable militaristic patriotism. I mean, you know, every year before the Super Bowl, the B-2 bomber flies over the Super Bowl. I think most people just think that, oh yeah, that's just like a cool plane that's flying over. But that is a plane that's designed to evade radar to drop nuclear weapons. And what does it say that the most watched TV event of the year, one of the most celebrated things, the thing that people bet the most money on, maybe one of the few things that can bring large numbers of people together across, that's not like an official holiday, across a variety of lines, that it opens up with the celebration of dropping nuclear bombs, or at least the capability to do so. I think every television show, every movie, we talk about this a lot in policing, that one of the problems in terms of how people conceive the police is because, you know, it's what they see on TV, right? Because they don't have any contact with the criminal justice system. I think it's the same thing with war. And it's so easy to, you know, reduce sort of the moral consequences of war or whatever in some movie to people making hard choices, but I don't think we think so heavily about the normalization of war and the militaristic solving of conflicts with movies, televisions, video games more than ever. There's certainly no surprise why the U.S. Army travels around in malls now and sets up video game things. And the realer these video games, these first-person shooters, they're the most popular games. All the kids want to play some Call of Duty something. Every kid I know, they want to play Call of Duty. And they're in them 6, 7, 8 hours a day. And they become so realistic that people are even developing groups of friends around the world on the basis of like murdering people in the context of these wars, which are often highly reactionary. You know, one of the Call of Duties, which is written, by the way, by Christopher Nolan, who wrote all those new Batman movies, you have to invade Venezuela and kill Hugo Chavez, who's a mortal threat to America and going to overthrow the United States and sending Hezbollah fighters to blow us all up. You know, I'm sure you've heard that before, but you get a sense that if you're a kid, how do you even know? I mean, you're being inculcated with these images day in and day out. And I think Dr. King was so good in focusing on the cultural roots of the violence that exist. And I think beyond the correctness or incorrectness of any particular war, certainly this was Obama's speech in 2008, you know, I'm not against all wars, I'm against dumb wars, or whatever the exact language was. I think we often forget how often we just sort of assume that there must be some sort of like good opportunity. Like, yes, there's got to be somewhere in the world where America, we should go to war, and that's good. And I think a lot of that is based on the normalization of war and violence as a problem-solving mechanism in our culture. I think third is the importance of broad-based coalitions. I'm reading this fantastic unpublished dissertation about the Poor People's Campaign. I have no idea why this gentleman did not publish this as a book. I feel like I want to look him up and like force him to do it. I mean, it's marvelous. No research out there like this. And it's all about, it's talking so much about the first, I think, maybe 100 pages about how they brought together this coalition for the Poor People's Campaign, the difficulties that it took to bring it together, but the importance of the singular role of King, and later in the book it talks about that's why things didn't work out as well in Resurrection City, but the singular focus of King and not only being able to build coalitions, but understanding how to subordinate sort of the core leading position of his own role, and certainly of the black struggle, which had brought everyone together. But there's all these new rising liberation movements that are coming together that to some degree felt marginalized and displaced because no one recognized the power of where they were coming from, and they certainly didn't have the same place in American culture as the African-American community because of the history of slavery, and the ability of King to subordinate and even say to some of his own lieutenants and people he had recruited to take a step back and to bring forward voices that hadn't been heard. And to really, I mean, some of those people, you know, King is a noted pacifist. Some of the folks who were coming from the Southwest who were part of the Poor People's Campaign made their name leading armed raids on courthouses to demand land rights for Chicano Americans and the abolition of a number of those borders and territories. And the ability to build a coalition around a nonviolent action from such a diverse group of people who at various times almost came to blows in the meeting, but finding a way to work it out, and the power of that History Now and the fact that the Poor People's Campaign in some ways I think has become maybe the marking campaign for a lot of progressive people in America, bringing a large swath of people together around sort of broadly economic concerns that people can share without downgrading the individual realities of various communities and their struggles. And I think that there's something, you know, very important to say about that. And the final thing I'll say about this, just to wrap here, is the importance of political independence. I was doing a little research, and I have to say this is very surprising to me, into the finances of SCLC after the Beyond Vietnam speech, because I was curious as to, you know, Taylor Branch has a fantastic trilogy on the civil rights movement. I think the last one, it's not as good as the first one, but it's good. And it, you know, I think it gives a good overview of a lot of the conflicts towards the end of King's life in terms of some of the institutional power bases that have been supporting him. And I obviously, when he steps out against the war, he heavily alienates President Lyndon Johnson. That has a huge impact on a lot of different things. And so I was just very surprised to see that Nelson Rockefeller had given SCLC $25,000 in 1967, like 2 months after the Beyond Vietnam speech. And he was for the war in Vietnam, Nelson Rockefeller. Now, all that being said, obviously he had his own reasons, but when you sort of read that back, the suppleness with which King was always able to, you know, take sides when sides needed to be taken, but to maintain sort of a scrupulously individual course based really on the goals of any one particular movement, I think is an important lesson, because it allowed him to sort of leverage different institutional pieces of power at particular moments and to exploit the differences and the contradictions amongst the people at the top in ways that were extraordinarily effective. And we could talk for some time about how he did that in the early 60s with Republicans and Democrats. But be that as it may, I think that's an extraordinarily important reality and attitude, because everyone who says they're the same thing as you doesn't really want the same thing as you. You know, Samora Machel, the leader of Mozambique, used to say, "Beware of the enemy who hides under the same color." The point being, just because someone is black doesn't mean that they're for African liberation. And I think the same thing can be said of, you know, Democrats, quite frankly. I guess I'll just open it up and be quite frank. Some Democrats are fantastic on war and peace issues. Some are terrible. So being a Democrat actually tells people very little about where you stand on war and peace issues. Now, certainly Democrats at certain moments can be the vehicle through which anti-war opinion can make itself known, heard, and effectuated in terms of legislation, no doubt about that. But in the most general sense, is there an anti-war movement, or is there a movement to build electoral majorities for the Democratic Party? And I think that distinction, there's a lot in there, and there's a lot of content in there, but I think certainly if it's a distinction that if we don't make, and certainly this is exactly what happened to Bayard Rustin, and I think this is an extremely relevant piece. He supported the war in Vietnam, ultimately, and became very wrapped up in the militaristic attitudes of the AFL, CIA, Solidarity Center is what I would call it, around the world overthrowing governments. And to the end of his life, it was a real sore point when people would raise with him how he'd given up his pacifist commitment to try to create a more durable political coalition with the labor movement, which was for the war. So I think that's just an important lesson in terms of reaching the ultimate goal through which we are trying to achieve. I don't think, you know, the ends don't necessarily justify the means in the most general sense, but I think in the way that certain ends can only be achieved through certain means, right? I think there's a lot of different things that you have to do, but there are some things that can take you down a road to where you'll never get where you want to go. Oh, and finally, the one piece in the Triple Evils, the importance of racism as a war and peace issue, which I think is shockingly underrated. I really don't know or understand why or how, but a huge ability of this country to go around the world and do the things it does is because it's able to easily dehumanize people as sort of lesser and other. I'll never forget the day of 9/11. This is the final thing I'll say, but this is a story. You know, the TV, and some of these images, I believe, turned out to be fake, start showing these images of people celebrating that the Twin Towers had gone down. The one they kept coming back to was Pakistan. And I think that was the one that ended up being fake, either that or Gaza. And it was, so my teacher has gone completely AWOL at this moment. He's in actually the side closet throwing things in the closet, so he's gone. So the students are running, the inmates running the asylum here. And everybody in the class, except I have to give her credit, my girlfriend at the time, Hattie Smith, she lives in San Francisco now, she was the only one, everyone in there started saying, "We gotta go over there and we gotta bomb those people, we gotta kill those people." And it was just crazy to me how quickly this like bloodlust erupted amongst people inside of the class, and that everyone just agreed. And I think at the time I certainly didn't see it, but I think I see it now more clearly than I did then, when there's such a strong othering racist reality that exists in America, it's extraordinarily easy to push demonized narratives about any country that is a non-European derived nation, at least in terms of how they conceive of themselves. And I think that's how narratives like this can pick up so quickly. I mean, you just think about, say, Korea and what's happening in there. Whatever you think about the government, the whole basis of the opposition of the United States to, you know, North Korea is that they're weird and they have nuclear weapons. And they're nothing like us, so they must be terrible. Iran, same thing. Africa is just like one large, dark Warren Joseph Conrad novel. And I think that's why you don't hear anything about the massive buildup of military forces in Africa right now, because people, oh, well, all those Africans are always fighting over there. Aren't all those Africans fighting? Don't they need somebody to come in there and keep the peace? I think the importance of that to the ability of the war machine to do what it does is so key. So I'll stop there. Thank you very much.
Let's fast forward another 50 years to the present. Medea Benjamin is the co-founder of Code Pink, and her books include Kingdom of the Unjust, Behind the U.S.-Saudi Connection. Medea Benjamin.
Well, first I wanted to say how thankful I am to David Swanson and World Without War, because I think you've given a new sort of umbrella to a lot of our work, not focusing on one war, another war, but focusing on the whole thing of war. As Dr. Martin Luther King said, he said, I think war is obsolete. What I think he meant is war should be obsolete. But David, you've really taken it, I think, very much to heart in the whole construction of the organization, that it's about ending war. Having also commemorating this 50 years of Martin Luther King, when you go back and you look at that speech, it's just astounding. I mean, to think at that time when so many Americans were dying in Vietnam, how hard it is to then come out and not only say that the U.S. was wrong for being there, but say that the U.S. was the greatest purveyor of violence in the world, is an extremely difficult and revolutionary thing to say. But let's remember also at that time, because so many Americans were dying, there was an anti-war movement that was being built up that became very rich, enormous. You fast forward today and you see the difficulty we have of even getting people to pay attention to the fact there is not just one war going on, there are many wars going on. And I think the fact that the anti-war movement that actually was quite strong during the Bush years, when it was clear that we were trying to stop a war in Iraq, and people could understand that, and we could mobilize massive numbers of people, made it a lot easier to build up an anti-war movement. Then Obama came in, and the anti-war movement just fizzled out. And I think as a time for also self-reflection, we did a terrible job during these last 8 years, building awareness, building coalitions, getting a new generation of people to care about these issues. And so here we are after 8 years, to see that Obama, while he, as Dr. Martin Luther King, got a Nobel Peace Prize, one has to say, what the hell were the Nobel people doing giving him a prize when he was so engaged not only in drone wars but in bombing 7 different countries? If you just look at 2016 alone and look at the number of bombs that were dropped by Obama's administration, it was 26,712 bombs in that 1 year alone. And unbeknownst to the vast majority of the American people. And while he did do some positive things on the international front, like the Iran nuclear deal and opening up the relations with Cuba, for the most part, it was a continuation of allowing the military-industrial complex that General Eisenhower warned us about to still control our policies. Then we have the phenomena of Trump coming in. I think some people jokingly thought during the campaign, thinking that Trump would never win, that perhaps he was more of the anti-war candidate than Hillary Clinton was. We don't know what Hillary Clinton would have done in the first couple of months had she won, but we now see what Trump has done in a very short time. And it's not only just alienating entire sectors of the world like Latin America through his immigrant policy and the wall, and alienating the Arab Muslim community through the Muslim ban, but actually concrete things that he's been doing to increase U.S. intervention overseas. He has been, for example, well, we know he just met with General Sisi, that while Obama refused to meet with Sisi and did cut some of the money going to Egypt, it looks like President Trump just loves General Sisi and thinks it doesn't matter that he has 40,000 people in prison, that he came to power in a coup that that killed about 1,000 people, but he thinks that he is just a fine guy doing a great job. We also have the phenomena that while the Obama administration was very continued to give over $3 billion of tax money to the Israeli government, there were differences, and the Obama administration did say that they were against settlements. Here comes Trump, and he puts as U.S. ambassador to Israel somebody who's not only fine with settlements, somebody who's actually been financing those settlements. The Obama administration had the positive thing of the Iran nuclear deal. We see that President Trump not only trashes the Iran nuclear deal, but that he is becoming closer and closer to the adversaries of Iran as a way to really get at Iran. And I'm particularly thinking of the Saudis. While the Obama administration sold massive amounts of weapons to the Saudis, $115 billion worth, at the end of his time, after 8 years, it was actually in December, right before leaving office, I think he started to get second thoughts about it and put a halt on the sale of precision munitions to the Saudis, and also started pulling back a little in the support for the Saudis in their war in Yemen. Trump comes in and really, as part of his antagonizing of Iran, it looks like he is going to lift that halt on the sale of precision munitions, and that he is poised to get the U.S. more involved in the war in Yemen. In fact, we have a campaign right now with a bunch of the peace groups to try to halt this disastrous green light that the Trump administration might be giving any day now to the bombing of the main port in Yemen where the humanitarian goods come in, the port of Hudaydah. This is something that the Obama administration was against, and it looks like the Trump administration is for. If this actually happens, it will be even a greater catastrophe than has happened already, because as the UN advisors have said, Yemen is on the brink of famine. Bombing the port of Hudaydah will put Yemen into a famine situation. We also have the Trump increase in the drone strikes, more in January than had been done in the previous year. His increase in U.S. intervention in Iraq. We see more civilian casualties in the bombing in Mosul of a residential neighborhood than we saw since the U.S. intervention in 2003. And we see an increase in 400 troops to Syria, as well as bombing of a lot of civilian sites like schools and mosques. We see a loosening of the terms of engagement in Yemen and possibly also now in Somalia and in Afghanistan. In the meantime, there's also another 2,500 paratroopers that have been sent to a staging base in Kuwait. So it looks dire. And even with all of that, it has still been hard to get people to care and to understand how dangerous this particular aspect of the Trump administration is. But I would say that something changed quite significantly when Trump came out with his proposed budget. Even though the amount of the money going to the Pentagon has been enormous and bloated for such a long time, suddenly with Trump calling for an additional $54 billion, which is an increase of 10%, putting the U.S. Taxpayer giving over 60% of our discretionary funds now to the Pentagon, we now have a vehicle with which to do outreach to other sectors of the population. And when, Eugene, you talked about building coalitions, it's been very hard to build these coalitions. I know it was very hard for us as Code Pink to try to even insert the issue of peace into the Women's March, which we were really not able to do. David Swanson did a fabulous job, but had to get 10,000 signatures to get the people doing the climate march to even consider putting the word peace in there, and then they hid it in there so you can barely see it and it doesn't appear on any of the flyers and materials. For a variety of reasons, it's been very hard to get the peace issue inserted. Now that we have a $54 billion that is clearly coming from the budgets of other people's, other organizations, things they care about, whether it's the EPA or whether it's Wheels on Meals or whether it's the health departments or education or humanitarian aid, other organizations are starting to understand that this is directly affecting the work that they're doing. And we just were able to launch today a statement put out, I would say, for the first time by the heads of many, many organizations that have not typically been part of this peace movement. So the head of Greenpeace, Annie Leonard, the head of National Organization for Women, Terry O'Neill, people who started the Black Lives Matter movement, like Opel Tometi and Michelle Alexander. We have people from the indigenous movement. We have people from many organizations that have not paid attention to these issues and thanked us very much as we reached out to them to give them a chance to get on record being against another $54 billion for war. And we are seeing this as an opening now to get a place at the table, but also to get that table to be involved in these peace issues. I think another initiative that David started of these resolutions in city by city is something that we've done before on different issues, like trying to stop a war with Iran. Now we can follow the example and get our cities to pass these resolutions saying no $54 billion for war, and take this to the mayor's conference that will be happening in Miami Beach in June. And just in the outreach we've been doing, we're finding groups now coming to us and saying, let's work together. Let's see how this relates to sanctuary cities and freedom cities and bring the issue of the war money into those other coalitions. So I'm feeling quite inspired by the response we've been getting to that. Let me just throw out a couple of other things, because my job was to be, what are the kinds of things we can do? I mentioned that Yemen is on the brink of famine, and that one of the things we need to do, really, is to stop the weapon sales to the Saudis. It's why I wrote the book, to get this movement to understand that the U.S. is arming one of the most repressive, extremist countries in the world, and that we have to stop those weapon sales. Right now, we also, as I mentioned, have to stop the invasion, the attack on this port. But one thing we can do to start getting people to feel the pain is to join Kathy Kelly, Voices of Creative Nonviolence, who are starting a fast April 10th at the UN, outside the UN. And we have called on people to join on April 13th in either a day of fast, and if you can't do a day of fast, then do a lunch fast. And we're calling on people to give their money. You can do it through Code Pink. We're giving it to UNICEF. But really, this is just a symbolic way to start flexing that muscle of empathy that we have lost so much of and that Donald Trump disdains so much. And a couple of other things. We know that profit is so much the motive of war. We've been talking to groups, especially at Catholic universities, since the Pope came out and said that we should not remain silent in the face of the weapons manufacturers, about joining with the divestment campaigns against fossil fuels, the divestment campaigns that have grown up on campuses around this country, including things like divestment from Israeli companies, and adding the issue there of divestment from the weapons industry. Mentioning the issue of Israel-Palestine, that is the one area of our movement that really does have a lot of vim and vigor and young people involved in. It was exciting to see at the AIPAC protest last week, young people, hundreds of them from the If Not Now Jewish group, protesting and getting arrested in front of AIPAC. I just came this weekend from Jewish Voice for Peace, where over 1,000 people from the Jewish community, together with a lot of their brothers and sisters from the Palestinian community, came together to plot and strategize about how to build the movement for the rights of the Palestinians. And there's a lot of exciting work that can be done on the boycott, divestment, and sanctions as a strategy for that. it's been disheartening to see how few people in this country really understand how dangerous NATO is, and we have to build up the opposition in this country. And I hope that in our discussion we can talk about how we as progressive talk about Russia today, because we cannot fall into the Cold War trashing Russia if we want to do things like ever have a nuclear weapons ban, given that 14,000 of the 15,000 nuclear weapons are in the hands of the U.S. and Russia. I want to throw out some positive initiatives like one done by our colleague Christine Kahn called Women Cross the DMV, where we march from North Korea to South Korea, saying that if you want to deal with the Korean government, what you need to do is finally have a peace treaty to put an end to the Korean War dating back to the 1950s. And finally, I think, to go back to Martin Luther King and the radical things that he called for, because he did call for massive civil disobedience. He said we need massive civil disobedience to compel the unwilling federal authorities to yield to the mandates of justice. And that certainly resonates today. He also said, we have two choices, one of nonviolent coexistence or violent co-annihilation. And I would say 50 years later, as we are facing increased militarism, increased climate crisis, rampant racism, this call to nonviolent civil disobedience, nonviolent resistance, to upping our level of activism and the tactics that we use is something that resonates more than ever. Thank you.
You have been listening to voices from the program Remembering Past Wars and Preventing the Next, held April 4, 2017, marking 100 years since the United States entered World War I and 50 years since Martin Luther King Jr. made his famous speech against war, sponsored by the organization World Beyond War at Busboys and Poets 5th and K Streets in Northwest Washington. And that will do it for today's show. Thanks to our guest today, Gerald Horn. Also thanks to Lydia Curtis and Chantel James for their reporting for today's show. Thanks to our engineer, Michael Nasella. This is On the Ground, Voices of Resistance from the Nation's Capital, produced for WPFW Pacifica Radio in Washington, D.C. You can reach our show at onthegroundshow.org, where you can listen to all of our shows. You can also hear On the Ground on iTunes under WPFW Radio. Thanks, everyone, for listening. Please like our Facebook and Twitter pages at On the Ground Show. I'm Esther Averam. Keep raising your voice. Peace.